Well, good afternoon, and welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. As we all know, anxiety is a normal and important human experience that's necessary for motivation and for our very survival as a species. Anxiety, however, can become a frustrating and debilitating condition that can manifest as intense irrational fear, hypervigilance, panic, obsessive behaviors, and poor self-esteem. With rates around 20%, anxiety disorders are the most common mental health problem in children and adolescents. Ranging from generalized anxiety to social anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorders to phobias, anxiety disorders are a confusing, challenging, and frustrating experience for the teens who have them and for the people who love them. Joining me to discuss adolescent and anxiety disorders is psychiatrist Dr. Patrick Kelly from the Harbor UCLA Medical Center. Dr. Kelly is a psychiatrist and psychopharmacologist, board certified in both general and child and adolescent psychiatry. After completing his training at the Johns Hopkins Hospital and running the residency training program, he moved back to Los Angeles and is currently directing the emergency and consultation services with Harbor UCLA Medical Center, and also serves as a full-time professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kelly. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
All right. Before we get started, I want to let people know we can be reached, how we can be reached. You can call us locally at 550-8433. Reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Got to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. So if you have a question about adolescent anxiety, if you experienced it, go ahead and give us a call, and we'll get you on the air with Dr. Kelly. All right. Dr. Kelly, can you fill us in a little bit on quickly on what you're doing at UCLA and why your focus mood disorders and teens in particular?
Sure. So here at UCLA, I work primarily in the emergency room and on the consultation service to pediatricians. So I see a lot of kids who come in with some sort of a psychiatric emergency, whether that be suicidality or new onset symptoms. And a large proportion of the kids who come to us in distress have a mood disorder or are experiencing symptoms of a mood disorder or have anxiety. So along with being the most common disorders that we see in the general population, they really drive a ton of distress in young people's lives. And, you know, these are adult problems, but they can look very, very different in adolescents. And they weren't really being, I think, investigated or explored as thoroughly as they should be. So my co-author, Dr. Montemore, and I decided to focus on them and to hopefully spread a little bit of information about what they are and how they can be treated.
Yeah, I had for Line One listeners, they're probably familiar. I had Dr. Montemore, who's your colleague, and wrote the book with you, Adolescent, A Parent Guide for Adolescent Depression, which is available on that show. So that was a really good interview with Dr. Montemore. Now I guess we're swinging to the other side of that and discussing anxiety. I said on the intro that anxiety is normal and it's an important thing. Can you tell us a little bit what anxiety does for us as far as the strengths of anxiety?
Yeah, the bottom line is, just like you said, anxiety is really, really important, and it serves an evolutionary purpose. There's a type of psychotherapy called CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, and it starts with that premise that anxiety is normal and natural and in all of us, but we all have sort of an anxiety threshold. So our caveman ancestors, if they're walking through the jungle and they hear a scary noise or they see a tiger behind them, they're going to get anxious, they're going to want to get out of that situation, and they're going to run away. Anxiety can keep us alive. It can keep us motivated to do the things we need to do at work so that our boss doesn't yell at us or so that we don't fail school. Anxiety is normal and productive, but if anxiety goes overboard, It can do so in one of two ways. It can either feel like a tiger is chasing you all the time, and you could be constantly in this heightened state of anxiety, which isn't really helpful. You want to be able to relax and recharge when you can. Or your anxious response to life stressors can be so extreme that you have panic attacks and that it's just paralyzing. And even though your anxiety is trying to get you to do something to get out of the anxiety-provoking situation you're in, you actually just freeze up and can't move on. So even though anxiety is normal and necessary, it can get out of control, and that's when we start paying attention to it.
Yeah, I tell my clients all the time that every sound that you hear in the woods is not a bear. Sometimes it's just a squirrel.
Right.
And they get really that's a great analogy for anxiety, is every sound is a tiger, right? And it's coming for us. All right, so when does it, I guess you talked a little bit about when does it shift to maladaptive, and that's what we're talking about, a maladaptive, unhealthy anxiety, right? It was what you mentioned, kind of anxiety gone overboard and spilling over out of the cup, right?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
All right. You mentioned some of the things like panic and phobias and things like that, but can you break down anxiety disorders just real quick for our listeners? Like, what does that encompass? It's an umbrella term and it encompasses a lot of specific things. So could you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So anxiety does come in multiple different flavors. It is an umbrella term that holds a lot of disorders or categories underneath it. So one is generalized anxiety, which is just like it sounds like. It's the idea of every noise you hear is the tiger coming for you. It's somebody who just has an elevated level of anxiety in pretty much all situations. They don't even have to be in an anxiety-provoking one. Most of the other anxiety symptoms are related to a specific stressor or have very specific symptoms. So phobias, for example, specific phobias is being especially afraid of one particular situation or thing. In kids, fears of the dark, fears of animals are very, very common. But when it rises to the level that it interferes with your life, that's when it's a specific phobia that's deserving of treatment. Kids who won't leave the house because there might be a thunderstorm that's going to scare them. That's the sort of thing that we're talking about. Social phobia, social anxiety, is an anxious response to being in social situations, having to meet new people. So some kids are shy. They have a little bit more trouble meeting somebody new, and it takes them a little bit longer to warm up. But there are also kids who go to such an extreme that they have what we would call selective mutism. They can't speak in any situation outside of their family, or they're so afraid of meeting new people, they won't go to a restaurant with the rest of the family, or they break down in tears if they have to go to a party. That's sort of the common theme, is when it really starts interfering with your life, that's when we start to get worried about it. The big other anxiety disorder that I worry about is panic disorders. Mm-hmm. What's really scary about panic disorder is you don't necessarily have to have a stressor. In true panic, you can wake up in the midst of a panic disorder. Part of it's very biological, and it just comes over you from out of nowhere. And the symptoms of the panic disorder can be very, very extreme. People describe that they feel like they're going to die or that they're going crazy. It drives people to the emergency room. It's really, really distressing. And the unpredictability of it is partially the scariest part. So if somebody's having panic disorders, those we try to treat pretty aggressively, because eventually people start to fear when the next panic disorder attack will happen, which really constricts somebody's life. So that's a general overview of a lot of the anxiety disorders we see in kids. We're going through a transition in psychiatry right now where PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, used to be in the category of anxiety. Now it's in sort of its own category, trauma and related disorders.
Mm-hmm.
But it still is an excessive response to a stressor, to the trauma. So I don't think we'll talk too much about that today. But that's just for people who are asking, kind of, why didn't you bring up PTSD? We see that all the time, because it's sort of its own thing at this point.
All right, and that is that's a conversation for another day. Because you're right, that is its own topic. I have our first caller on the line. They must have called right away because they've been on hold for a few minutes. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm glad you have this subject. My friend had panic attacks about 4 years ago, and her doctor put her on Xanax and a sleep pill. and she has been on this for a long, long time. She no longer has panic attacks, but I know that she is having problems with anxiety. Everything seems to be a problem for her. I was wondering if you could tell me how I could help her, how I could advise her, how to get off these other drugs, and just have a life, because not having a life, she's not having a life.
Okay, Dr. Kelly, you want to take a stab at that? Thanks a lot, Pat, for the call.
Thank you.
Sure, absolutely. This is actually a fantastic question, because it speaks to what treatment for these disorders is and what it's really not, and how it can evolve and change over time. So medications in the class of benzodiazepines, Xanax is one, and the sleeping pill is likely another one, they work very well for panic in the short term. They're really a Band-Aid, but for that time, they really are helpful. So if someone is really suffering with panic attacks that are disabling, getting in the way of their life, they're so afraid of the next one that they can't even leave the house, having something like a Xanax, which really quells the panic attack in that moment, can be very helpful. But those medications are best used in a very time-limited way. In the long run, you really want to give somebody the skills and the ability to deal with the panic themselves. If somebody doesn't have those skills, you know, saying, oh, just deal with your panic is cruel. But you do want to take the time and through something like CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, help them manage the panic themselves so that they can get off of medications like Xanax, like this type of sleeping pill. Skills, not pills, is sort of what we always talk about. There are other types of medications. The SSRIs, the antidepressants, which is actually not a great name for that category, because they do treat anxiety as well, and in some studies actually better than they treat depression. And those can be very effective in the long run in just bringing down that anxiety threshold, so that things like generalized anxiety disorder don't take up so much mental space, so much of somebody's time. So, you know, Pat, I would say that the best thing you could do is advocating for your friend and having a conversation about getting involved in more dedicated psychotherapy to deal with the type of symptoms that your friend is having, and then to have a good discussion with the psychiatrist about what are these medications doing for me at this point, are they still necessary, and are there other options that I could explore.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Pat. Thanks for the call. I kind of, when you were talking there, Dr. Kelly, I kind of had the impression of like a statin drug that takes away the like immediate risk of like a heart attack, and then people start working on lifestyle changes and maybe they don't need them later.
I think that's a very good analogy. Something to deal with the problem immediately, but then you have to do behavior work, and you have to get to the root of the problem eventually. You can't just keep the Band-Aid on forever.
Okay, for folks who might be tuning in late, my guest today is mood disorder expert Dr. Patrick Kelly from the UCLA Medical Center. Our topic today is adolescent anxiety disorders. You can reach us with your questions or comments at our local phone number, 550-8433. Reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, or you can email us to line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, since we're talking about adolescents, let's get to the prevalence. What are the numbers for adolescents? I mentioned it in the intro, but can you talk a little bit about that? What's the scope of the problem?
So it's a really big problem. The prevalence is a little bit hard to capture at any given time, to some extent because of the willingness, I guess you could say, of parents to bring their kids in to actually get treated for anxiety. But it's assumed that about a quarter of kids will meet criteria for an anxiety disorder at some point during their adolescence. We see, obviously, the most extreme in our anxiety clinics and even in our dedicated mental health treatment centers, but among mental health disorders that we treat, it's absolutely the most common one that we see. So the good news is that even though it's common, we do have very effective treatments for it. As you get to the subdivisions, they become a little bit less common. The rarest in kids is panic disorders, which is good because it's probably of them all the most disabling. But social phobia is actually very common, and the line between general shyness and social phobia can sometimes be a hard one to draw. So what we usually use, again, in determining the need for treatment is how disabling are these conditions for a patient's life. So they are fairly common, and like I said, there's no reason to be afraid of them. They can be treated. So it's better to seek treatment than to hope that they go away over time.
Yeah, I see a lot of parents get into my office, and the kid's like 14, 15, but they've had anxiety for quite a few years. It's been since really childhood, and you know, people write it off to teenage angst or, you know, the shyness factor, or they just don't get along well with their friends. But it's a real problem, and I think earlier that it gets addressed, the better. Okay, we have another phone call. Alyssa, you're on the line with Dr. Kelly. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. The lady who called in earlier about kind of talking about how to help her friend, when I first started getting anxiety, I did do, you know, short-term things like lorazepam or Valium. And I found, for me, in the long run, like, that was kind of harmful.
Uh-huh.
And it was really crucial for me to get a hold of my anxiety to take a maintenance medication like Zoloft or one of those SSRIs. That was really, really helpful. So hopefully her friend is able to get a handle on that. And I know how hard panic attacks are.
Yeah.
If you wait it out and find the right medication, a maintenance medication is really worth it.
That's a good comment. Alyssa, do you mind telling us when you started noticing anxiety problems for yourself? Did it happen to be when you were a teenager, since that's what we're talking about?
I was more depressed when I was a kid. My anxiety disorders started when I was probably 18 or 19.
Okay.
I became pretty like hypervigilant, and I didn't know what was wrong, and just couldn't get a handle on myself. But I'm 30 now, and I do pretty well. When I start to notice anxiety cropping up, I know, you know, I have another important thing is to just have like a plan of, okay, you need to call your therapist, you need to get in for an appointment, you need to, you know, start taking your medication, et cetera, et cetera.
So you've learned ways to, you've learned the tools, as Dr. Kelly said, skills, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, Alyssa, thanks very much for the call. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Yeah, Dr. Kelly, that's good advice from her.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely good advice. And a lot of people will say that after they go through that and they actually get off of the benzodiazepines, they learn that even though they're helpful in the short term, they're actually afraid of being without them. They become psychologically dependent on having those pills because they don't have any way to deal with the panic when it comes. So it almost in a way becomes even scarier. So learning to be able to deal with that yourself and taking that sense of control can do a lot just by itself to help alleviate anxiety and help people feel better. So I always say from day one that even though you're suffering with panic and even though these help, you really need to start getting in and seeing your therapist and learning those critical skills.
Okay. So causes of anxiety. I notice patterns. I've been doing this a long time working with people, and I notice patterns in families. There seems to be some lineage of anxiety or depression or addiction. I mean, pick your thing, and there seems to be sort of a pattern there in families. And what's the nature versus nurture? Can you speak to that? Are there things that parents do that can sort of facilitate their children developing an anxious brain? Nature versus nurture, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I think for an individual, it can be nature versus nurture, but in general, both seem to be at play. So there are certain families that just seem to have anxiety, depression, what have you, running through them like a river.
Mm-hmm.
And if you if you look at what's going on in their brains, we think it's related to the serotonin receptor, which is why selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors work so well. And it's just that people kind of are biologically prone to being more anxious than other people. What's really interesting is that the serotonin receptor, it's not just in your brain, it's in your GI tract too. So there's a very close relationship, and it's the same genetics, right, the same receptor. So there's actually a very close relationship between anxiety and stomach problems and GI problems. And you can see that run through families too. But even in kids who have that biological predisposition, there are definitely things that parents can do to recognize that early and to address it, even through their own anxiety. One of the things that we notice in our clinic is, just like we talked about earlier, anxiety to an extent can be protective. So we have a lot of parents who have probably mild to moderate anxiety that helps push them forward in life. They're high achieving. They do well at their job because they're afraid of doing poorly. And a lot of kids early on, these are the kids who come home and they do their homework right away because they don't want to be last in class, or they keep themselves organized, or they don't take risks. They don't go out. But eventually it can spread to the point where it's not adaptive anymore and it becomes a problem. So even though that anxiety was there all along, a lot of people aren't able to recognize it until much later. And parents can even reinforce anxiety. You know, Johnny, you're going to fail. You need to sit down and do your homework right now, and sort of pass that anxiety on to kids. If parents notice that they have an anxious streak in themselves, then actually the same type of treatment, going through that CBT, even if it's just to help the kid out and deal with their own anxiety as it relates to their child, can be really helpful, because nothing freaks a kid out more than seeing their parent anxious. Kids will take a lot from their parent's state of mind, so if a parent can remain calm, cool, and collected and help a kid sort of strategize around their anxious times, that's going to do wonders for that kid's own anxiety.
Okay, so don't freak out when your kid's freaking out. I mean,
try not to freak out.
Yeah,
it becomes a spiral. It just reinforces itself.
Yeah, it's a tricky balance because I mean, that anxiety creates. I mean, you have to have some anxiety as a parent, clearly.
Sure.
But if you do have a child who is a worrier, then I know and I see all the time parents inadvertently, not out of, you know, not because they want to create an anxious kid, but they reinforce that fear. And worry. So that's something people should be aware of, and get your kid in, get him some help with somebody who's maybe not quite as attached and can take a step back.
Right, and that's the other thing that we see is that sometimes parents, in an attempt to protect the kid from anxiety, really shelter them to the extent where the kid doesn't develop any of their own skills. And part of CBT for kids is actually letting them go through that anxiety so that they learn how to deal with it. And that could be really hard for parents to let your kid suffer in order for them to learn their own skills and not try to take that away from them. So CBT is not, you know, I'm throwing it out a lot, but it can be a challenging process, but it's very, very important to actually learn, for parents to learn to step back a little bit and let the kid have some of that anxiety so they learn how to deal with it.
And they learn that it's not going to kill them, right? It's not.
Right. It's very important.
They're going to be okay. They're going to recover.
Yep.
That's an important lesson. So, all right, so ACEs, like the adverse childhood experiences, that's talked about a lot. So can you just discuss real quickly the impact that multiple, like, traumatic experiences in early childhood can sort of lay the foundation, the groundwork for later anxiety problems?
Yeah, absolutely. So it creates a sense of hypervigilance, like Alyssa was talking about, that having those, they're not really microaggressions, but having those very small traumatic experiences leads a child to expect those traumatic experiences to continue, right? That's how kids learn. It's through repetition, it's through experiencing things and seeing what happens. So if a kid walks up to the stove and puts their hand on it and the stove's hot, they're not going to put their hand on it again. And that's a predictable response. But if they go up to somebody to say hi and that person yells back at them, unfortunately, the kid begins to assume that people are going to yell at them, even if that was just a one-off experience. So kids can have anxiety reinforced just like they can have anything else reinforced. And parents paying attention to those adverse child experiences and trying to ameliorate them as much as possible can help mitigate the development of anxiety long-term. And also, if something really does happen that the parents are noticing, sitting down down, and I don't want to use the word debrief because in anxiety and trauma literature that has a specific meaning, but just sitting down and discussing what happened and, you know, how are we safe? How can we prevent those things from happening next time? How can we take back a sense of control, really, can help the kid deal with that in a much more effective manner than just sort of internalizing that assumption that this is going to happen again the next time.
Right. They process it and go through it and feel okay about it. All right. You mentioned earlier something really brief that I want to get back to. Kids, you said teenagers, anxiety disorders can manifest differently in teens than adults. And can you talk a little bit about that? What's that look like, some of the differences?
Sure. So it can be really interesting. For kids, even though the phenomenon is the same, and as kids grow up, you'll see it in adulthood, the actual way it comes across may be different. We actually have kids who get very anxious, and the way that anxiety, so the anxious pressure, right, is to get out of the situation that's making them anxious. Whereas adults have more control over their environment and will remove themselves from that activity, kids don't have that option. So they'll try to, and making this sound conscious, it's not always a conscious decision, but they'll do whatever they can to get out of that environment. So we've had very anxious, very quiet kids be brought into our emergency room for throwing a chair across the room or for, you know, running up screaming at their teacher because they know. And again, it's not malicious, but they know that that's going to get them out of this anxiety-provoking situation. So anxiety in kids, it can come across as aggression. It can come across as sort of an ADHD-type symptom where they're so frozen all the time, they're not able to focus on what's in front of them. It can come across as depression. It can come across as a number of things. So we always really have anxiety on our radar, again, because it's the most common condition we see when kids are brought to us for pretty much anything, just to make sure that that's not going on in the background. The flip side of that, there is an anxious condition that I didn't really touch on, obsessive-compulsive disorder. And what's really interesting is the obsessions and compulsions in kids and adults can look very similar. It's almost striking how a kid with OCD can look very, very similar to how an adult looks with OCD. And same with panic disorders. A panic attack in a kid looks very similar to how it looks in adults. So it's more the generalized and the social anxiety and how kids react to it that can look very, very different in a kid.
Yeah, and it's so... I mean, it's so complex because anxiety, a depressed kid or a kid who can't pay attention because they have ADHD will get a lot of anxiety about going to school and having tests, and they don't want to deal with their friends. So one thing sort of, I mean, they often exist together, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. And unfortunately for us, the medications that we use to treat ADHD most of the time, the stimulants, can make anxiety worse. So if you misdiagnose anxiety as ADHD, not only are you missing it, but you might be making the original problem worse than it was to begin with. So we spend a lot of time screening for anxiety in our population.
Well, does that matter which order they came in? Because, I mean, a lot of kids with ADD and ADHD are really, really anxious because they can't read and they can't do these things. And so if you treat the ADHD, if it's the primary, does it not create that anxious response, or do you have to treat the anxiety first?
No, I think you're exactly right. I do think it matters very much what order it comes in, because you're right. Kids who have ADHD, who keep dropping the ball, who keep forgetting their keys, they're constantly checking themselves, and they do get very anxious about that. And actually, if you treat the ADHD, it gets much better. The other side of that is that there are kids who are primarily anxious, and they're so anxious all the time. They forget things, and they lose things, and they're not able to keep themselves organized. So in that case, if you just treat the ADHD, it makes the anxiety worse. So we do a fairly complete assessment on all of the kids who come in to determine which came first, which are present, and then talk to the parents about what their family history may be like, because that can drive us down one decision-making tree or another.
Gotcha.
In terms of treatment, from a pharmacologic standpoint, a lot of times we'll try a treatment for ADHD first, just because those medications tend to work faster and you sort of know where you are
right
on a quicker basis. Sometimes you have to treat them together. You have to treat both conditions. From a therapeutic standpoint, the types of CBT that you use for anxiety, they contain such core helpful skills that we would never hold that back from a kid who had ADHD or anxiety. But a lot of CBT therapists will note that they're treating a kid for anxiety, and they always forget their homework, or they forget what the assignment was, or they just didn't do it, and then ADHD starts to rise a little bit higher on the scale.
Yeah, a lot of times it'll be a while before I kind of can figure out exactly what the sort of underlying condition is that we need to target the most.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I mentioned teenage angst. What's normal teenage angst versus an anxiety disorder? And when should parents maybe get concerned and, seek out some additional support?
Yeah, so childhood, adolescence, it's a time of change. It's a time of identity diffusion. Kids are learning where they fit in the world, how to interact with people. So a lot of kids will have times where they go through anxious periods or they go through moody periods. When I usually tell parents to get concerned is either if the degree of the anxiety is out of proportion to what they would expect. Like I said, if someone's just paralyzed by the anxiety, if they're not able to function, if they refuse to attend school and they throw fits and won't get out of the car when you pull up, or if they are so afraid of the dark that they won't sleep in their own bed, that mom and dad always have to be with them. If it's really interfering with their life, then it might be time to at least get a consultation with somebody. Getting a consultation, seeing a psychiatrist or a therapist, you're not committing to treatment. You still have the choice as part of the treatment team, and parents are an integral part of the treatment team with what's going to happen after that. It's just getting an opinion.
It's getting information,
Getting information, exactly. The other thing that I tell parents to look for is the persistence of these symptoms. You know, a lot of things happen in phases. But if somebody has even a relatively mild anxiety that persists for years and years and years and doesn't seem to be letting up, or a sort of social anxiety that, they're sort of like the rest of their peers and we kind of describe them as shy, but they really haven't grown out of this. You know, we assume when they turn 12, 13, they'd start making more friends, and that's just not happening. Then, it might be time to at least get more information, at least get a second opinion about what's going on.
Okay, we're at the halfway point in our show, so we're going to go ahead now and take a little break. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. My guest today is mood disorder expert Dr. Patrick Kelly from Harbor UCLA Medical Center. Our topic today is adolescent anxiety disorder. So you can reach us at 550-8433. Call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can always email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Kelly. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is mood disorder expert Dr. Patrick Kelly from Harbor UCLA Medical Center. Our topic today is adolescent anxiety disorders. As always, you can email all your questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember the show repeats tonight at 8. So if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording and we won't be accepting any phone calls. All right. Let me read an email here. We got one from a listener. It says, how does cognitive behavioral therapy work for kids and adults? How can parents help kids age 10 to 13 who won't talk or admit they have anxiety issues, especially related to social phobias? How do hormonal changes, puberty, menopause in girls affect anxiety? Can they increase it? Dr. Kelly?
The answer to all of those is pretty much yes. So puberty, hormones, all of those are big changes, big times of change in a young person's life. To make this more clear, when we look at epidemiological studies, the incidence of mood disorders, depression, primarily starts with puberty. That's when something seems to get unlocked that a lot of these things come forward. So it's not uncommon, actually,
right,
for someone to develop a mental health concern around that time. So that's absolutely correct. In terms of how CBT works, it really takes somebody on a journey through steps forward to be able to deal with their feelings. So one of the premises of CBT is that it's really hard to change somebody's feelings directly, to change the anxiety directly, but that feelings, thoughts, and behaviors are all connected. So by changing somebody's thoughts and changing somebody's behaviors, what they do, what they're doing, you can actually get around that and change the feelings sort of in a roundabout way. So it teaches somebody to actively challenge their anxious thoughts and to go through exercises of relaxation of different types so that if an anxiety-provoking stimulus comes up, these ways to deal with anxiety become so ingrained in a person that they do them almost automatically. But like anything else that eventually becomes automatic, there's a lot of effort that goes into it in the foreground, sort of like riding a bike. Riding a bike for somebody who's never ridden a bike is hard, but eventually you just hop on the bike and don't even think about what you're doing. CBT can be very similar. And I forget the third part of the question. I apologize, Prentice.
No, I think you hit them all. I guess you did say help. How do you help kids who won't talk or admit they have anxiety issues? They're saying everything's fine at school and they're not having any problems with their friends, but you know something's wrong. How do you get them to open up? How do you get them to talk about what's going on?
Yes. So there might actually be two parts to that question. A lot of adolescents have what we call alexithymia. What that means is that they're sort of unaware of how they feel. Because kids don't have a lot of experience with emotions or a lot of language to describe it, a lot of kids won't even realize that they're feeling anxious. So one thing that CBT does, and that a lot of psychotherapies do, is that they really back everything up to the very, very basics. You know, how do you feel? Do your hands feel hot or do they feel cold? If you're in a certain situation, do you notice that you feel more clammy? Do you feel your blood pressure going up? Do you feel flushed in your face? These can be signs of anxiety, or these can be signs that something's happening. So some kids really have to be explicitly tuned into their feelings in that way. So somebody may be saying that they don't have anxiety because they really don't realize that they have anxiety, and it may just be a lack of insight. If somebody's really defended against their anxiety, if they just don't want to admit it for a reason of pride or because they don't want to go see a psychiatrist, they don't want to see a therapist, that can be a little more difficult because ideally you'd want to sort of work with somebody so that they realize how impairing the anxiety can be in their life, which could motivate them to change it, to actually seek something to improve that. But for kids and adolescents, just sort of hammering away at that resistance, it doesn't really help.
Right.
A lot of times getting involved in sort of a general therapeutic relationship and not necessarily starting something specific like CBT, just working on that relationship and developing that bond can be a good first step. So actually by involving somebody, but by backing off and actually treating the anxiety and leaning on the relationship a little bit more, that can be a good way to lower those defenses and make somebody treatable. But I agree with the person who asked this question that those can be absolutely the most difficult patients to get into treatment and to get going with.
Yeah, the resistant ones. And I've found that a lot of kids they may not know that the way they're feeling is how, I mean, they think everybody feels that way. They don't have any other
right.
experience of that. They're like, I guess this is just what everybody's dealing with and I got to deal with it. So them learning that there's a whole bunch of other people out there that are dealing with the same issues sort of reduces that stigma and that that I have there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with all of us, right? I mean, that's that's the reality. Everybody's got something, and how you deal with it and how you address it is what's really important.
Yeah, very true. And I think the reduced stigma against mental health and people being more open to having these sorts of conversations is really helping to open that up a little bit, because everybody wants to go around and pretend like nothing's wrong. And you look at Facebook and Snapchat and all those things, and it's just happy people doing fun stuff. But that's not what most people do most of the time.
You think, what amazing lives everybody else is leading. All right. I got Tim. You're on the air with Dr. Kelly. Go ahead.
Dr. Kelly, working, this is going to harp back a little bit to the comment about post-traumatic stress disorder, but it may also apply a little bit, because we do have adolescent soldiers that we are treating nowadays, oddly enough.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these soldiers who were in severe combat situations, when they would be having panic attacks after they returned home, they would have a real difficult time relating to the term panic attack, because they were attacked with bullets and bombs and by other soldiers. So changing the language of panic and anxiety was very helpful for them. By calling a panic attack not an attack at all, because it's not an attack, it was coming from inside of them, and they recognized that, well, it was just anxiety. So the term would be acute anxiety episode, because it was episodic, it would pass, it came on very acutely, and it was a heightened state of anxiety. And if that terminology could be used more frequently with people who are having generalized anxieties, it might be very helpful for them.
All right, that's a good point, Tim. I think you're speaking to how we talk to people about the anxiety and using words that don't increase it or stigmatize it or make it sound bad.
Correct. Some people don't get that till they get into cognitive behavioral therapy or some
right.
form of therapy, but they may never get that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Tim. Dr. Kelly, you got a comment on that?
I mean, I think Tim's really very right that language can be incredibly important to people. The medical community is always struggling with that, with what to call things. There was a while ago where the name for a stroke, cerebral ischemia or hemorrhage, was changed to a brain attack, because people take heart attacks very seriously,
right.
but they weren't taking strokes as seriously. So they tried to sort of increase that anxious drive to get to the emergency room and deal with this as quickly as possible. But that's true, that for somebody to experience something called a panic attack and not be able to really mesh that in their minds with what they consider an attack can be really destructive and not helpful. So calling it a panic episode or an acute anxious episode, like a mood disorder episode, can be very, very useful. And a good therapist will be able to pay attention to that and see how their client, their patient, is responding to those. And you can make adjustments. You know, for OCD in kids, we don't call them obsessions. We call them worry bugs. And how do you fight against the worry bugs? So playing with language to make it fit a person's pre-existing cognitive schema can be super helpful.
Yeah, those are really good points. I think it's, you can take your kid and tell them they don't have anything to worry about. And what are you always worrying about? And you're actually making them feel bad about their anxiety, right? Instead of noticing it and sitting with them and hearing them and being present to hearing their fear. And because it's a real fear. It's a thing. It's mm-hmm. not made up. They're not trying to get something out of it. So it's important how we talk. All right, let's moving down the line here. So if they're concerned, if you got a kid, what do you do first? Is a pediatrician a good place to start? Do you call a therapist? Do you start with a psychiatrist? What's the first line? What's the first move?
Yeah, really good question. So most kids are attached to a pediatrician and have a relationship with that person. I usually tell parents to have a conversation with the pediatrician about what do you think our next best step is, because pediatricians usually have good relationships with psychiatrists and with therapists in the community. Where somebody goes from there can, to an extent, be up to them. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist. I have my own thoughts about this, but if you're looking to make sure you're not missing something, that you're screening for everything you can think of, both medical and psychiatric, that could be causing the types of symptoms, child and adolescent psychiatrist is probably the best step, because they can run labs, they can make sure that certain medical conditions that can look like anxiety, hyperthyroidism, aren't going on at the same time, and can also have discussions about what might be the best treatment. Now, I know a lot of parents are hesitant to take their kid to a psychiatrist because they equate psychiatry just with medication. Oh, my kid's going to be put on a pill, That's not what I'm looking for, therefore I'm not going to see a psychiatrist. A good psychiatrist should never rush into any type of treatment, especially if the parents are resistant to it. That's what the interactive discussion is about. That said, I'm also sensitive to the fact that there aren't a lot of us out there, and it can be hard to find. And so starting with a psychotherapist, with another person that you can get a good relationship with, who can talk about anxiety, who can give you information on what this might be, is a perfectly reasonable step. What I would say is that if you do go to somebody, go to your pediatrician, your psychiatrist, your child, your therapist, and you hear something that just doesn't sound right or doesn't jive, like, oh, this is a phase, don't worry about it, I see 100 kids like this, this will just pass, but you're still worried, you don't think that's quite right, there's no problem with taking somebody to get a second opinion. I have a lot of parents who are so nervous about that, or they won't tell me that they've gone to somebody else just to get a second opinion. We're all working together for the betterment of your child. So that's a great discussion to have with the pediatrician, with the therapist, so that everybody can be on the same treatment team. So I would say for parents, follow your instincts, probably start with the pediatrician, but maybe you've seen your own therapist and you trust that person. You can always get a referral from them. But if you're worried about your kid, definitely take action and be reassured that just by getting that first appointment, just seeing that person for the first time, like I said, you're not committing to a certain treatment that you might not agree with. You're just getting more information. You're just getting another set of experienced eyes on the problem at hand.
Right. A psychiatrist is not necessarily just going to load up your kid with a bunch of medications.
Right.
Another thing I always tell folks is go ahead and ask your friends, how their kids are doing. And what you'll find if you talk to your friends about how their kids are doing is you'll have some friends who have kids with dealing with anxiety or depression, and maybe they have a therapist or a psychiatrist that they really like and trust. And that's an important piece. You have to, your therapist has to be somebody that people feel good about. So, all right, I got another call. Donna, you have a question for Dr. Kelly. Go ahead.
Hi. My son was treated for acute anxiety from the time he was in fifth grade until he graduated from high school. And he's recently gone on to college and is doing well, although he seems to be feeling, obviously a little down. I'm just wondering, and he's chosen not to see any therapist on his college campus. So I'm wondering, is this something that will follow him through adulthood and that we need to be aware about? Should I, have somebody on hand for him to talk to if he wants to? How does a parent kind of hand this over to the kid, as he becomes an adult? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a great question. Dr.
That
Kelly?
That totally makes sense, and it's a very complicated issue, so I'm glad you're bringing it up.
Thank you. It's not been easy.
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Kelly.
Well, so one of the areas that you're talking about, how a kid becomes an adult, that's a whole area of transition that psychiatry is beginning to pay much more close attention to, because it's not magic that someone turns 18 and all of a sudden they're responsible for their own decisions. And it's actually a disservice just to sort of thrust them into that adult world with no transition plan. One thing that and it happens at just the wrong time, one thing I tell all of my patients and parents is that there's so much change inherent in going to college that that's really not the time to change all the mental health treatment that you've been going through or that you've been getting. It happens all the time that kids are so excited to go to college, they can sort of reinvent themselves, they can be that person who doesn't have anxiety, they can be that person who doesn't need to see a therapist. But actually, continuing those services are what's going to allow you to be the very best person that you can be and to really flourish in college. Now, whether anxiety is going to follow your kid into his adulthood, I wouldn't be able to answer that question. That's really, really hard. If it's more biological in origin, then it's likely. If it is based on some experiences that he had that he's working through, then probably not. But the point is that that's really going to be something for him and his care team to decide about. And having regular check-ins with a therapist, even if it's every month or every couple of months, just to make sure things are going along on the right basis and on the right trajectory, is actually a really good idea. Now, I know a lot of parents and a lot of patients who don't want to go to the student mental health services at the college that they're attending, even though a lot of times that's free, just because they don't want to mix their academic records and their mental health treatment records. And I can understand that. College mental health services are a great resource. They're fabulous. I would never defer or deter anybody from going to them. But if parents and patients want to see somebody else, there are almost always a good number of therapists in the community around a college who have experience treating that age group. So, I think it's helpful to advocate that, just like one of the first things you do when you move to a new city, when you move to a new town, you find a good doctor or you find a good pediatrician, you find somebody so that if something comes up, you know where to go. You don't want to deal with having to find somebody when something bad is happening already. You want to have that card in your back pocket. I encourage the same thing for all of my kids going away to college. Just find somebody, have a meeting, even if it's an initial appointment for, I had anxiety, I'm feeling pretty good now. Can we just talk about what I can look for in the future? I really think that's a really helpful thing to set up right at the outset.
All right. Hope that answers some of your questions, Donna.
It does. Thank you.
All right. Those are really good points. I have a lot of kids I work with, primary 50% teenagers probably. And so a lot of the kids that I work with go away to college at some point and they say, well, I don't ever want another therapist. And I'm like, well, there's a lot of good therapists out there. And you don't want to have to find one when you're really depressed or you're really anxious or you're having panic attacks.
Yep.
You want to have somebody that you already know and feel good about. That you can call and go in and talk to. So those are good points. Medications, parents have a lot of fear about that. You're right. And you're putting kids on anxiety medications, some of the Xanax, the panic attack stuff. What are the risks there, the risk of treating versus the risk of not treating?
Yeah, so the risk of treating and the risk of not treating is a really, really good way to conceptualize it, because a lot of parents think about just the risk of the medication. What could this do to help my kid? What could this do to not help? But there's also a risk to doing nothing in anxiety. There can
Absolutely.
Be a risk to not treating. So that class of medication, the benzodiazepines, one thing that's helpful to remember for parents is that they work in your body and in your brain very similarly to how alcohol works. If somebody is a severe alcoholic, comes into my hospital and is withdrawing from alcohol, we don't give them alcohol. We give them a benzodiazepine. That's how similar it is in your body. So they work very quickly, but they can be addictive. That's why it's really important to keep them on a very time-limited basis and to use them just as prescribed, just for when the panic attack happens, and to have a plan to move on from there, that they're really a Band-Aid. They're not meant for long-term treatment. The medications that we do use for long-term treatment, the SSRIs, the other antidepressants, again, a lot of parents are really concerned about those. There's that big black box warning by the FDA that we can talk more about, but that in some studies, there's a suggestion that they might actually increase the risk of suicidal thinking in adolescents. And parents parents worry, isn't that what we're trying to treat? I don't want to make my kids suicidal. You know, that's why you have a good psychiatrist. And while that's certainly something to watch out for, I can tell you that I personally have never seen that happen to a kid, and I know a lot of child psychiatrists who always say that, you know, the biggest risk for those types of events are untreated anxiety and depression, not the medications meant to treat those. We've had these around for long enough that we've been able to follow people who have taken these medications for 40, 50 years. There don't seem to be any long-term consequences to being on them long-term. And actually, most people who do end up taking them, there's a constant evaluation process. And a lot of people take them for 6 months to a year and then get off of them while they're acquiring skills, while they're learning to deal with the anxiety and depression themselves without having to necessarily rely on a medication. So in my practice, I do try to keep medication to low doses, short-term, constantly reevaluating their utility and their usefulness. But if I really see somebody who's suffering and I think it's going to be helpful, I'll have a frank conversation about that. You know, what's the risk of not doing anything? What could happen to this anxiety if it gets worse or if it continues to keep somebody out of school, keep somebody from making friends? You know, that can be harmful too.
Yeah, I work with a lot of kids who haven't been treated, but man, they sure aren't functioning very well. And then they'll start self-medicating and start, you know, doing stuff that makes them feel better. So there's the risk that somebody else will give them some medicine if you don't. So something to think about. Can you talk real briefly, since we're almost out of time, and I wish we had another hour because we could do more, but the group of kids that 4.0, student government, playing sports, work, universally loved, and they really don't like themselves and they feel like a failure and they worry all the time. What do we do with those kids?
Yeah, so those kids can be very, very hard to treat because from the outside, from the rest of the world, they look like they're doing perfect. So it's very easy to dismiss their negative feelings or say, oh, you're just being silly. Of course you're perfect. Like, just stop it. Just
yeah, look at
together.
You. Look at you. You're great.
Yeah, absolutely. But really, sometimes the reason those kids do so well is because they have the sense that they're never good enough. So they really push themselves. And even though they may be achieving highly, it's a torturous existence. It's a really difficult way to go through life. So I'll be honest, for a lot of those kids, I do think about whether a relatively low dose of an antidepressant for a short period of time as a trial might help. You know, a lot of these kids are dysthymic. They don't even know what it's like to feel good. They can't They can't get joy. They can't get satisfaction from the things that they're doing. So those are hard kids to treat. And because they do achieve so well, they have a sense that their symptoms, their anxiety and depression is what gets them to do well. So they're really attached to anxiety in sort of a weird way.
It reinforces their
success. It's hard to get them to relax. Yeah, it reinforces it, exactly.
All right, we are just about out of time. So can you give us something that you want folks to take home, a sort of a parting shot?
Sure. So I think the biggest thing is that anxiety is it is useful. It can be necessary, but if it gets out of control, it can really, really hurt a kid's life, and it may not necessarily go away by itself. So if you're worried about your kids, definitely talk to your pediatrician, try to find a therapist, educate yourself online. The American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry has whole guides just for parents about anxiety. So don't be shy. Don't pretend it's just going to go away by itself, because we have really, really effective treatments that can help a kid lead a more fulfilling life.
Okay. My thanks to today's guest, Dr. Patrick Kelly. It was a pleasure having you join me today. I really appreciate the information.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Please remember to check out the variety of links and information we have available on today's topic. Just go to alaskapublic.org and click on the link to today's show. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can join us on Facebook. You can find that link on our website. That's alaskapublic.org. I'd like to take a second to issue a challenge to Line 1 listeners. I'm interested in hearing about topics and guests that you'd like for me to explore in one of our mental health programs. So send your ideas or thoughts to line1@alaskapublic.org with the subject or guest you're interested in, and I'll work on getting your topic on the air in the coming months. Statins are a cholesterol-lowering medication found to reduce cardiovascular disease and mortality in those at high risk. Despite the benefits, patients are electing to stop them. Next time on Line 1, the risk and benefits of statins with Dr. Thad Woodard. That's Monday, October 24th at 2 p.m. Repeating that same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1, Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron is our web editor for today's show. Thanks for taking the time to join us today on Line 1. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.